There was a time when it was a rare treat to spot a white-tailed deer in Iowa. That treat is no longer rare. This hour, our love-hate relationship with these beautiful animals. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here. Today, we'll talk about the history of white-tailed deer in our state, their place in the environment, and our complicated relationship with them. We'll also talk about the diseases that can plague deer in Iowa, management questions, and get some suggestions on how to live in peace with the deer that live in our neighborhoods. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. White-tailed deer are stunningly beautiful and fun to watch, but they're also plentiful. They're easy to hit with your car and often enjoy eating your ornamental plants. This hour, white-tailed deer and our complicated relationship with them, or as Jim Pease insists on calling the program, "Oh dear, what can the matter be?" Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here today. Hello, Jim.
Good morning. How are you, Terry?
I'm very good. How are you today?
I'm good. It's another gorgeous. This can't be November. Can
no, it
this
can't.
Is September, I think.
It's beautiful. Let's just enjoy it while it lasts.
Right.
And, you know, white-tailed deer have certainly had their ups and downs as far as population goes through our history. Let's go way back prior to settlement. How common were white-tailed deer in this part of the country?
Well, they were very common, and they were certainly the large ungulate, which means a hooved, split-hooved animal, in this part of the country. We certainly had some other species occasionally. We certainly had elk, that's for sure. But in most of Iowa, white-tailed deer was the dominant large grazing species, along with bison and some elk, but over much of the state, white-tailed deer were very, very common. Certainly, when Euro-American settlers arrived here in the 1830s, deer were common throughout the area. In fact, if you look at A Country So Full of Game, which is Jim Dinsmore's sort of historical treatment of it, of the history of wildlife species. Deer were so common that they were seen quite commonly in the state. And in fact, as Euro-Americans started doing that tough business of pioneering, spreading across the state, there were really no laws that governed their take of wildlife species, and deer and elk and bison became the primary animal protein source for thousands and thousands of pioneers.
And they had played an important role as a source of food for Native Americans as well before settlement. And, of course, with the pioneers, there were a lot more people to take deer. And you mentioned them along with bison. I mean, they nearly shared a similar fate with bison, didn't they?
Yeah, exactly. In fact, by the turn of the century, and in fact, we should say that it wasn't through what we would call hunting today. It was harvest in a totally unsustainable manner that caused this. By the turn of the century, market hunting, which was take as many as you want, as often as you can, whenever you want, you know, this sort of totally unsustainable approach to other animals that share the planet with us, and as a result, by the turn of the century, deer were basically gone from Iowa. That's hard to believe. That's 1900, so that's 115 years ago. There were no deer left in the state of Iowa. That's remarkable. Just hard to believe, but that's in fact what that kind of pressure can do to a species across the United States. The estimate was by 1900, in the early 1900s, there were only about 300,000 deer, white-tailed deer, left in the whole country.
Wow.
That's amazing, isn't it? I mean, that's you know, they shoot more than that every year today in the state of Wisconsin every season. So it can show you what this lack of regulation and what human greed basically can do.
So when did deer start being protected then in Iowa? If they had pretty much disappeared, I mean, there was action taken to say, hey, this is a species we want around.
Yeah. In fact, around that turn of the century, hunters and conservationists alike were saying, wait a minute, something's wrong here. People like Teddy Roosevelt came to the rescue, and his administration and lots of other people like him around the country came to realize that this was not only diminishing, but we were very likely to lose these wild critters. And so there were laws passed in a number of states, but really enforcement was so difficult. It wasn't until the 1930s, for example, when an Iowan by the name of Ding Darling went to Washington, D.C., to become part of the FDR, the Franklin Roosevelt administration, and head of the U.S. Biological Survey. It was only when he went there in the mid-1930s that he sent federal marshals out across the nation to actually enforce some of the laws that had been on the books for a generation. Just amazing. So they had already been on the books for 30, 40 years and hadn't really been enforced very much. So it was really in the 1930s when they began to be enforced, and efforts were really made at restoration in many places, not only of deer but of other species as well across the country. And so and they grew, certainly. The populations came back due to a measure of enforcement and sort of the biology of the species. Deer are, as we'll talk about, are generalists in many ways and can adapt to a variety of different habitats. And so between the regulation and the enforcement of regulation, some their own adaptability and the elimination of large predators from much of the environment, particularly wolves and mountain lions, that their populations began to expand. Now, the first modern hunting season in Iowa came about not until 1953. I will say that that's in my lifetime. So in 1953, there were about 4,000 deer harvested in Iowa for the first harvest in the 20th century, legal harvest in the 20th century in Iowa.
Now, and at that time, estimates were that the statewide population was just over 10,000?
Yeah. It wasn't over 10,000. It was certainly more than that.
Okay. But 1950, the estimates were in 10,000. So
right,
this first
right.
hunting season in 53, things right, had grown. Okay.
Yeah, had grown since then. And they've continued to grow. And part of that is due to the change in the landscape. Let's talk a little bit about deer biology, because they eat a wide variety of plants. In fact, white-tailed deer have been recorded to consume over 350 different species of plants. I mean, that's amazing. That's a pretty wide diet, and so they're much more adaptable, sort of an adaptable generalist, as I just said earlier, than we originally thought they were. And as a result, with a landscape that was changing more and more to agricultural crops, including small grains, alfalfa, hay fields, and certain amount of corn and beans. Boy, they adapted very, very well. In fact, in Iowa, they began, we have some of the largest and healthiest deer in the nation. The upper Midwest is known for some very, very large deer, both in terms of body size and antler size. But and they're very, very productive. One-year-old fawns tend to have 1-year-old does tend to have fawns that very first year. That's unusual in wild populations. It particularly of slow, you know, generally slow reproducing species that only have one or two offspring per year. It usually takes a few years before they get to that point, but not in deer in Iowa. So one-year-old does have fawns. So.
And often we see does with twins or even triplets. Why are there so many multiple births with fawns or with does?
With does, and it's because of the food that they eat is what it comes down to. There's probably some genetics in it, but it's mostly the health of the doe. The healthiness of the doe depends, largely influences how many young she will have. And in this case, twins are very common after, a two-year-old or a doe reaches 2 years of age. And triplets seem to occur 8 to 12% of the time among healthy older adult does. So it's all a matter of nutrition, and they get
a lot
of that.
So because the food is so abundant, then the does are more likely to have multiple offspring.
Exactly. So
we've really, by transforming our landscape in Iowa, we've destroyed habitat for many kinds of species, but we've kind of made the ideal habitat for the white-tailed deer.
Yeah, and although that has limits, because certainly cover is a the amount of cover that they would have, particularly in the wintertime, has changed dramatically in the last decade and a half, as more and more land has gone out of small acreages of trees and shrubs and, so-called wasteland, and gone into row crop production, less and less, as for other species as well, but less and less land is available, less and less good habitat, particularly in the wintertime, which is the limiting season, is available for deer.
So that does put pressure on the population. We'll also talk about how management techniques and the hunting season interacts with sort of those natural population dynamics as well. Can you give me, before we get to the break, can you give me an idea of what the population of white-tailed deer is in Iowa today?
Well, it all depends on one's these are purely estimates, and it's probably in the neighborhood of 300,000 deer in Iowa, but it certainly will vary from where you are in the state how you make your estimates. If you're just driving to work every morning, you might say, geez, I'm seeing deer every morning. And in my area, they're much more abundant than that. But we don't have a good handle. We have an index, and that index is based on the hunter success rate each year in each part of the state.
All right, and we will talk more about that in just a few minutes. But suffice it to say, there are a lot of white-tailed deer in Iowa. I'm talking with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. He is an environmental interpretive and wildlife consultant based in Ames, also an emeritus professor at Iowa State University. And we will take your calls, answer your questions, get your insight. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here today. We're talking about white-tailed deer in Iowa. We'd love to hear from you with your questions, 866-780-9100, your observations as well. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Jim, let's talk a little bit about the yearly cycle with deer. You mentioned that even one-year-old does can produce offspring.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we should start way back in the fall.
Right, like right now.
Right, as we start thinking about the year in the life of deer.
Yeah.
But a lot of important things happen this time of year and in weeks prior, right?
Yeah, and what's happening, we're right now, this very week, in sort of probably the peak of the rut season. The rut is the breeding season for deer. So they breed in the fall of the year, and this is the peak time. As a result, drivers beware. And if you are driving any time, but especially at around dawn and dusk, early hours of the morning and evening, which is when a lot of people go on to and from work, be extra cautious because deer have one thing on their mind right now, and it's breeding, not watching for cars or even eating. Bucks, the males at this time of year, often don't eat for very much at all for a matter of several weeks. They'll lose weight during the rutting season as a result, because they're only interested in seeking out does that are in estrus, that are in breeding condition and ovulating. So they are often wandering across or running across roads in front of us. So be careful out there. So they breed at this time of year, and but the breeding, of course, is spread out. I think everyone who spends any time outdoors has probably seen fawns, and I get reports from people all the time that say, well, gee, this is August, and I'm still seeing spots on fawns. And that's true, because does, increasingly, it seems, sort of spread out as a species. When the fawns are born, and they can be born anytime from probably late March up through June or even into July. And you think to yourself, now, why would a species do that? Why wouldn't they concentrate them? Well, because as a species, they're sort of hedging their bets, if you will. They're saying, you know, if we the species spreads out its breeding cycle, changes, then the species is better able to adapt to changes in the environment, either from drought, which are short-term climatic effects, too much rain, the opposite of drought, of course, and more long-term climatic effects like global warming. As that changes the habitat availability, the weather, and other such things, the species that is more adaptable to those changes in the environment. So it makes some sense that deer, being an adaptable critter, have actually sort of spread out that breeding season. So the breeding starts anywhere from early October through end of November, early December, and then the young are born in the spring and early summer.
So the females are pregnant throughout the winter months.
Correct.
And deer tend to group together during those winter months. What is that about?
Yeah, it's actually probably comes from a time in which deer in this part of the country, they don't have to fear it anymore. But it certainly is a protection, this sort of what's called yarding behavior in deer. They will tend to yard up in the wintertime as a protection against predators. More eyes, more ears available for protection against wolves and mountain lions in particular, but wolves in this case, in this part of the country. It probably has as much to do with that as anything, because if they yard up in the winter, it allows predators to be seen more easily, and the chances of many of the deer surviving go up. The other reason, of course, is that particularly in the northern part of their range, deep winter snows are a hazard for a hindrance, I should say, for this small-hoofed species. Moose, on the other hand, which are much better adapted to deep snows, they have a different shoulder socket arrangement, so their legs can lift out of the snow. And they have much larger hooves, which give them almost a snowshoe ability on snow, whereas deer do not. They will sink right in with those nicely pointed tail toenails that we call hooves, and they sink right into the snow. So the more deer you have around, the more the snow gets trampled down, the easier it is to get around. The downside of a yarding behavior in deer, particularly in the northern part, and this would be mainly now today, Minnesota and Wisconsin, Michigan, that sort of behavior is pretty common. The downside is that the food supply can get depleted in a small area pretty quickly. So that's not necessarily adaptive to them in that area. But apparently the protection in numbers is more important than the reduction in food supply.
Now, you mentioned when the fawns arrive in the spring, and at that point, the does are pretty much on their own with their fawns. So do deer just pretty much go all their separate ways once it starts to warm up?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, pretty much. They will tend to reduce their home range in the wintertime, and then in the spring it spreads out. In fact, they may change areas entirely. Their spring and summer range may overlap, but be quite different from their fall and winter range. And that has to do with breeding and certainly the availability of cover, particularly from cold winter winds and snows. So those ranges may overlap, but they're often quite different and at different times of the year.
Now, we started with breeding season, and of course the males put on some pretty fabulous displays to attract the attention of females. We see some conflicts arise among males.
Right.
Do we know, and many of the females have multiple births, do all of those babies have the same father? That's not always the case in different species.
No, not always the case at all. And in fact, they may have different fathers if they've been bred. However, if a big buck is very successful at keeping his harem close together,
he may be the father of every single one, right?
Exactly. And so it varies from area to area. How many bucks are in the area? How aggressive they are? How successful they are at keeping other bucks away. And they'll do that through a number of means. They do that, as you said, the displays of, where they'll combat one another, locking horn, not locking, but
hopefully not.
Right. Pushing each other around with their antlers. But there are other signs as well, and they include territorial signs that are more subtle. But if you are accustomed to looking for these sorts of things in the landscape, you can find scrapes in the ground. That is an area where a deer has taken its hooves, and it might be from 1 to 3 feet in diameter. And they urinate in that, glands on their legs give off pheromones then in that spot, and that says it's sort of like an olfactory signpost that says this is Georgia's area. You better stay out. And Georgia's one tough bugger, you know, and he's the best guy in the area. The other thing they do is they certainly have these rubs. And the rub is where, because the antlers are shed every year and regrow through the summer and into the fall, in the fall of the year, the antlers, the blood supply to the antlers is cut off. And that velvet that covered those tissues during the summer, when it was living tissue, it itches. And so they'll rub against those antlers up against trees, and you'll often see these rubs where they've actually, long after the velvet is gone, they continue to do that because they have glands that give off, scent glands, which give off, again, a pheromone that says, this is Sam's territory, and we don't want to go into Sam's territory. So it's a combination of the itching of the antlers and a territorial sign as well.
Interesting. So, all right, back to springtime. When the fawns arrive, the does are pretty much on their own. They can have 1, 2, or 3 babies. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people come across fawns mm-hmm. on their own and, of course, think that they need to be rescued. They do not need to be rescued.
That's
but
right.
let's talk about what is happening there.
Yeah, it's interesting because it has to do with conceptions of motherhood. Our idea of motherhood, because our babies are born, they're not blind or deaf at birth, but they're certainly totally dependent upon parental input for both sustenance, and they can't walk or anything for several years. But in deer, they're essentially what we would call precocial. They immediately begin to walk at birth and have their eyes and ears open and are able to get around. They're not fast, however, and they're small, one would say from a predator standpoint, bite-size morsels for lots and lots of predators, including in Iowa. It wouldn't be unusual for coyotes to take fawns. Small predators like coyotes can easily feed on fawns.
Right. Well, and domestic dogs are a danger to them as well.
Yeah.
Not a historical danger, but
right.
a very real and present danger.
Right. Yeah. So the fawns are often left alone. They have a different. They tend to have a lower, because of body size and other things, they tend to have less smell than the adult does do, and they have spots on them, which if you are a small animal and you're curled up in the leaves in the dappling sun in a woodland or a woodland edge, you look just like the forest floor, and that's exactly what they want. So the spots on them are adaptive for camouflage. And so the doe will leave them behind while she goes out and feeds in the area. So people stumble across these fawns that are hidden in the grass or hidden in the leaves, and they say, oh my gosh, it must be abandoned. And it's not at all, of course. The doe is nearby. You just haven't seen her.
All right. As the summer goes on, of course, the fawns get stronger and mm-hmm. faster. So you actually see them with their mothers more when they're older, right?
Right. And certainly a lot of twins end up as the mother will only end up with only one. And that's fairly common as well. Fawns, we have a lot of roads in Iowa. Fawns are not as fast as the does. They frequently get hit on the roads. They get preyed upon. They're more subject to, because they haven't developed all of their immunities yet, even though they get much of that from the mother's milk, they certainly die of some diseases. So by the fall, the fawns are half to grown or more, and half, three-quarters grown, and have been narrowed down in terms of population as to how many are still around.
In the fall, as those spots come off, do the fawns get a lot more independent? I mean, I will see during the winter groups of three or four deer together, and a few of them are smaller. So it seems that some of them do stick with their mothers.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they'll stay around, certainly in the same area. And certainly if they're yarding up in the river in the winter, they're frequently related to one another, and does and yearlings at that point, or not quite yearlings, will stick together through the winter months. That's interesting too. During this time period is the change in their food supply, and this is one of the things that the fawns have to adapt to. Does, other adult deer, have gone through the change because fawns haven't necessarily. And the change is the change from an herbaceous diet. Things that are plants that are not woody plants, to basically a woody diet in the wintertime. So in the spring and summer, they're eating things like grasses, the leaves of trees and shrubs, lots of herbaceous herbs, on prairies and in woodlands. And then in the winter, that changes over to a purely a woody diet. In fact, if you go out and you find some of these little elongated piles of deer feces on the ground that are about the size of a peanut each, and if you kind of take those apart, basically it looks like sawdust. It's because that's what it is. In the wintertime, that's the winter droppings of deer. They have eaten woody plants, and their special ruminant digestion is able to break down the lignans and other things in woody plants and extract the nutrition from that. So it takes a special kind of bacteria in the rumen in order to digest those woody plants. And that's a tough transition, and that's being made at this time of the year as well. this year a little later than usual because we haven't had a killing frost, so there's still lots of herbaceous plants around to be eaten. But making that transition, a change in the stomach flora, in the flora that are the bacteria that are in that rumen, is not an easy transition to make. And it's when a lot of fawns are lost.
Now, of course, in any species you want to avoid inbreeding, is there a point during the year that either the males or the females disperse to avoid inbreeding in the next season?
Yeah, in fact, that happens at this time of year. The males certainly expand their range as they in search of females during the breeding season. And then again, that seasonal change, that home range changes for the females as well. As I said earlier, the winter range is not necessarily the same as the summer range. It may overlap, but it might not. In fact, there have been some radio collared studies of showing that does, well, they tend to stay within the same 10 or 15 mile, square mile area throughout their lifetime. There are some deer that move 40, 50 miles away from that home range, usually in the search for better range or in search of a mate.
Now, we're going to take a short break. We have a lot of people who want to join in on this conversation with questions and comments. We will get to some calls right after the break. And we'll also talk about some of the diseases that plague white-tailed deer in Iowa and elsewhere. We'll talk about management issues as well in just a moment. With me today, wildlife biologist Jim Pease, and you can join the conversation. Our email is talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can also call 866-780-9100, and you can tweet us at IPR Talk. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about white-tailed deer with wildlife biologist Jim Pease, and you are welcome to join the conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we're going to start with a question from Kevin, who has a question that I think a lot of people have. He says, obviously, deer can see, or they couldn't run through the woods without running into trees. Why can't they avoid cars? I realize cars present a totally different phenomenon from what they've evolved to cope with, but what is it about their perception that they don't see headlights in the darkness?
Yeah, that's a great question, and they see about as well as we can. If you spend much time outdoors in the dark, your eyes gradually adjust once you get away from incandescent or other lights, and you actually can see fairly well, but not perfectly, and that's about what they see. Secondly, they have very little color differentiation. The cones in their eyes are relatively few, so they don't really see a lot of color. So their primary it's light and dark sorts of things. At night, their eyes are adjusted, and then all of a sudden, headlights coming at them, and they get blinded by those. We also have a lot of roads in Iowa. We have primary roads. I think we have over 90,000 or something approaching 90,000 miles of primary and secondary roads in the state. And that's to say nothing of all the other gravel roads and other such things that we have in the state. So we have we're well provisioned with lots and lots of roads. Road speeds have gone up over the years, although they may say 55. We have more cars on the road. It just increases the chances. Annually, at one point, we were approaching in the neighborhood of 13,000 deer car accidents a year. And since the deer population has been reduced in the last decade, we've seen that number go down. I don't have the current figure in front of me. Perhaps one of our callers who is more familiar with the insurance figures than I am can tell us exactly how many were killed last year. But that's a lot. That's certainly a lot. But it's not a matter of just their vision. It's a matter of what they're doing. This time of year, car deer, I saw a dead deer this morning driving in and hit by a car, obviously, during the night, or a truck. And people not paying attention, deer not paying attention, not looking out for each other, it's going to end up badly for the deer.
Well, and to the question about why can't they adjust, I mean, evolution is a slow process.
Yeah.
But this is something that is completely foreign to any kind of danger that they would have evolved to cope with, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Nothing, no predator moves as fast as cars do, so as cars and trucks do. So, yeah, it's not something that they adapt to easily or quickly. And the density of roads is very, very high as well.
Well, and here's a question on a similar topic, but it also brings in the management questions as well. As you mentioned, we may have 300,000 deer in the state of Iowa. This is a question from Merle in Jessup, wondering why the DNR shouldn't be held accountable for, quote, mismanaging the deer herd to accommodate a small and declining percentage of the population, hunters, to the point it's become a nuisance and safety hazard. The DNR claim the deer receive income from the licenses and keep the population high for their benefit. There are 200 people killed per year in the United States. Property damage amounts to over $2 billion a year, and the DNR claims the deer herd is a boon to the state, but do not take into consideration or deduct the amount of damage done yearly. And Merle has had a very sad event in their family. He says, our 49-year-old son was involved in a motorcycle deer accident in March and went from a healthy, productive wage earner and father of five to an individual with a traumatic brain injury.
Right.
And so, obviously, this is an issue very close to his heart. But,
sure,
you know, we do have an incredibly high population of deer. The way that deer have been managed in the state has allowed that and even encouraged that. Mm-hmm. So is there an accountability issue?
Well, I think the accountability issue has to do with all of human activity. Accountability, you know, how much are we accountable for our own actions, everything from smoking to fossil fuel consumption to, you know, driving too fast, driving without a seatbelt, on and on and on. And we like to blame these things on other folks when, in fact, we do lots of things to ourselves that are destructive as well. Who is accountable? Certainly the DNR has managed deer up until 10, 15 years ago to have an increasing herd, because that was seen. We saw what happened the last century when we allowed people to take whatever they wanted, whenever they wanted, as many as they wanted, and wildlife populations went down to we lost some, and we nearly lost many, many other wildlife populations. So through the first three quarters of a century, departments of natural resources across the nation managed deer for an increasing herd. I remember in Wisconsin, when Wisconsin got to, I was a student at the University of Wisconsin, when Wisconsin got to their first 100,000 deer harvest season. And there was a big celebration because among the wildlife community, because they thought, gee, our management is really having an impact. We can have lots and lots of deer harvested each year and still have a growing population. And we that happened in Iowa. Now we sort of regularly find right around 100 or more thousand shot during the hunting season each year. So certainly they were managing for an increasing herd. That changed in the late 90s, mid-90s to around 2000. And all of a sudden, because of increasing car deer collisions, because the cultural carrying capacity of the land, not the physical carrying capacity, but the cultural, the human tolerance for deer changed, they changed their management. They did respond to the public need, and they increased the doe take, they increased the numbers of seasons, on and on and on. And some would say that, in fact, the deer population is too low now because success rates and even seeing them has gone down. Other people certainly disagree. Merle, I'm sure, would disagree with that. But But it's a question I think the Department of Natural Resources and anybody managing wildlife has to deal with, is what is this cultural carrying capacity? And there are some folks who are very tolerant of high densities of, critters, and some that are not tolerant of having any around at all. We've talked about many times in the program, some folks don't want a single thing. They want the perfect lawn, for example. So tolerance levels vary, and the DNR is charged with trying to balance those varying parts of society and what their needs are.
Before we move entirely on from deer on the roads, here's a question from Sarah. She says, I frequently see deer when I'm biking long distance. If I see them ahead, I stop and keep my distance till they move along. I've gotten lucky on closer and more unexpected confrontations where I've needed to dodge them. Any advice for next time?
Yeah, just keep an eye out, particularly when you're biking through areas that provide good cover for deer. Be aware of that, and certainly that's true of especially time of year. This time of year, the fall of the year, is when the vast majority of car deer accidents, car motorcycle, car bicycle accidents occur, because the deer are unaware of they're less aware of people being around.
They have other things on their mind.
Other things on their
mind. Well, and I this is anecdotal from my experience, but I have found that it's pretty easy to frighten a deer by shouting at it, or and it seems like honking a horn at a deer is more effective than flashing lights. Is that right. Your experience too?
Yeah, I would say so, although they may just freeze as a result. And if they're freezing in the middle of the road, you don't want to swerve to, unless you're on a motorcycle. If you're on a, in a car, you do not swerve to avoid a deer, because that can make things worse for you. If it was a moose, it'd be another thing. But we don't have to worry about that in Iowa. So.
All right. So just hit
the brakes. Horn honking may help, but hit your brakes. Do not swerve.
And just go slow and be aware.
Right. Right.
All right, let's get to the phones. Bill is on the line in Sac City. Hi, Bill.
Oh, hi, Charity, and thank you for taking my call, and thank you to Dr. Pease, too, for this excellent program.
Sure.
I own approximately 300 acres of timber, and I've planted thousands of trees, and one thing I've learned is that unless I protect a hardwood tree, such as a walnut, oak, hickory, or black cherry, or any other species, unless I protect them with a tree shelter or woven wire, it does not survive due to the deer browsing. And in general, I see very little natural regeneration of oaks and other desirable hardwoods, not only in my timber, but other timbers as well. And I thus see white-tailed deer, they can have a degrading effect, effect as far as the quality of the hardwood timber. And what I see then is that less desirable tree species and shrubs invade the timbers, which generally produce much less of a mast and or nut crop, which is really essential for a lot of our wildlife species.
Sure.
And it's just an observation, and I'm not anti-deer bunny stretch. In fact, I hunt them and enjoy seeing them as much as anybody, but they do change the outlook or the what our timbers are turning into.
Yeah, there's no question about that. In fact, there's a lot of research that comes out of North America about changing composition, both in the herbaceous layer of woodlands as well as the replacement species, as you've mentioned, particularly nut species, their ability to survive. I have oak trees that I planted on my land, and they're the same age, and I have some that are 25 feet tall and some that are still under 3 feet, very heavily gray, browsed on every single year. And they resprout, but boy, they're having,
having a hard time.
Real struggle. And I think that's typical for woodland owners around the state. And I think it's gotten worse as we've lost woodland habitat, as more and more woodland habitat has been put, been taken down and put into row crop production, or taken over by city expansion. It makes it the woodland that is left. It puts increasing pressure by deer and other things on those small woodlands, including yours and mine. And it certainly can. The browsing certainly does change the composition of the forest. There's no question at all.
Well, and on the subject of changed habitat in Iowa, this is a question from Ron in Illinois. He said, what is the effect of cover crops on the diet of deer? That seems like something they would really enjoy.
Yeah, as a matter of fact. And I don't know of any recent research on that, but certainly cover crops may become very important in the fall diet, fall and early winter diets of deer as cover crops get more and more accepted across this part of the country. But I don't know of any research that's been done on that. So it would make sense that it would certainly change their fall and early winter diets.
Now, before we run out of time, I want to ask you about in other parts of the Midwest, of other parts of the nation, there have been a lot of problems with, for example, chronic wasting disease among deer herds. How are our deer in Iowa doing health-wise?
Well, we have two diseases. We have more than that, but two diseases that are certainly impacting deer herds in certain areas. One of them is EHD, epizootic hemorrhagic disease, also called blue tongue if it's in other animals, and probably due to our changing climate. It used to be something we've always had a little bit of in southern Iowa. It's spread by midges, which hatch around water areas, and causes deer to, among other things, have a great deal of thirst, and they eventually usually succumb to it. They'll die from it, and they're often found near water. Well, in recent years, I would say in the last 15 to 20 years, we've seen more and more cases farther north in Iowa. It used to be common in southern Iowa. You'd always see a few. We're now talking in the thousands that seem to die of it every year, and it has spread farther and farther north. So we're certainly concerned about EHD. And some years, warm years with lots of rain, like this year, it's worse than others. The other one is chronic wasting disease, and this is a disease that we've talked about before in this program, and which is here in Iowa, and it has come from two sources. One, certainly there are wild deer in Allamaquis County, in the northeastern part of the state, the DNR has been testing over 4,000 deer a year for many years now, because it is in surrounding states in Wisconsin, Illinois, some parts of Minnesota. So we expected it to come here, but until 2014, we hadn't seen it in Iowa. But the other source of it is through deer farms and hunting preserves, where they'll bring in genetics from other places, and that has brought it to there. There was a case in Iowa, actually one deer farm in Iowa down in Davis County. Deer from that farm also in Sergordo County and in a western county in the state. And there was a February 2015 federal court ruling that said under current Iowa law, the DNR doesn't have the ability to force the landowner to maintain the fence around the facility. So the fence has gone down, and CWD and wild deer now have access, which seems crazy to me and you and probably lots of people, but that's that was the federal court's ruling on that. So it is here in Iowa. What will happen to the deer herd in the future, I think, is a big question in lots of people's minds right now, and certainly something that we're concerned about. When we look at the recovery of deer from the turn of the last century to threats at the turn of this century, it could be an interesting century ahead.
Jim Pease, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Wildlife biologist Jim Pease, he is an environmental interpretive and wildlife consultant based in Ames, also an emeritus professor at Iowa State University. He joins us once a month to talk about Iowa's wild creatures and wild places. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can get in touch with us anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at IPR Talk. Follow me on Twitter at Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.